it is my distinct pleasure to introduce our afternoon keynote speaker, Mike Goodchild, a man who is for many of us synonymous with GI science. After early training in physics and geography, Mike taught at the University of Western Ontario and then at the University of California at Santa Barbara. There, he was the Jack and Laura Dangerman Chair of Geography until his retirement in 2012. Mike's CV is a fine example of the sort of large data set that data science is intended to confront. And I lack the algorithms to process his publications, academic honors, and honorary positions. So I'm not even going to try. But I will simply state that Mike has been and continues to be one of the most insightful and prescient voices on the current and future state of geography. So join me in welcoming Mike Goodchild.
Thank you. Thank you for that introduction. Thank you for the opportunity to revisit CGA after a few years. This was intended, I think, as a twin to this morning's keynote to represent the GI science side of the house rather than data science. And I'm going to give a somewhat personal view of GI science. The Landscape of GI Science is a title that was given to me. I want to talk about four particular aspects of that landscape. Some of this may sound a little bit like GI Science 101, for those of you who are very familiar with the field. And I am going to use some examples that are my favorites, and I apologize to anyone who may happen to have seen any of them before. But let's start with a formal definition of GI science. There are various definitions around. These are the ones that appeal to me. The systematic study of the fundamental issues raised by geospatial technologies. And I'll explain what some of those issues are. That are the fundamental issues the knowledge that is implemented in geospatial technologies, and what one thinks about when using geospatial technologies. This is something that's often been referred to as critical spatial thinking. What goes on in your head? The point here being that the use of geospatial technologies is not purely the use of an automated system. It's necessary for various reasons, which I'll try to explain, to think about what you're doing. And so what goes on in your head is in many ways a measure of how astute, how experienced you are in using geospatial technologies. Here's another. This will become important towards the end. How well does the database, and if you like, read map, as a more traditional view, represent the real world, if you like, read the territory? And this takes us to a very well-known quotation from 1931, "The map is not the territory." And I just participated in a book, just came out a couple of weeks ago, on that title, in which there are about 20 chapters, several written by Nobel laureates, and only one of them deals with the specific geographic interpretation. The map is not the territory is an idea that can be applied essentially to any discipline. And also, finally, the knowledge that helps us build these systems. And that's something that I'm going to illustrate. What will follow is a somewhat personal choice, and I have emphasized some of the things that are particularly useful in designing and building geospatial technologies. Okay, let me begin, though, with this question, what's in a name? Because this has been something of a concern recently, I think. I'd like just to introduce a few points in that connection. The term GI science was introduced in a 1992 paper, and at that point, I was deliberately making a play on the acronym GIS. The point being, what does the S stand for? Well, it could stand for science. It's the traditionally for systems, but if there's intellectual content in this whole field, let's have it stand for science. Spatial information science is another term that's widely used. Geomatics, geoinformatics. There are many, many competitors for this title of the underlying principles. There's the question of data versus information, which Alex kindly referred to this morning. Many people would define the distinction between data and information as information being data that is fit for purpose, suggesting then that migrating back to data and data science rather than information science is actually somewhat retrograde, because it suggests that by emphasizing data, we're not necessarily insisting on information that's useful for fit for purpose. All of this makes, to some extent, GI science a subset of information science, which is something I'm a little unhappy with. if we rename this geographic data science or spatial data science, that would be a subset of data science. And here's my personal view of this. Personally, I like to think of the G as the primary and the rest as the secondary. So if G is the primary and data science is the subset, this is not a subset of data science, it's a subset of geography. That suggests a title such as digital geography, which I'd be very happy with, except it carries all the baggage of the discipline of geography. And I think Esri has been utterly brilliant in adopting this science of where title, which in many ways covers exactly what I've been saying. Unfortunately, Esri's trademarked it. I don't think I need to put the TM there, but so the first area I'd like to talk about is data management. This is rather mechanical. It's not, to me, terribly interesting, but it has been a large part of GI science. It's a large part of the landscape of GI science. So let's take first curation, data curation. And Peter Fox and I were both on a panel. The National Academy wrote a report preparing the workforce for digital curation. It's on the web, came out a couple of years ago. And to me, right at the beginning of that discussion in that committee, the biggest question was whether data curation was generic, applicable to all kinds of data, or whether one needed to be domain specific. Whether the curation of spatial data was inherently different from the curation of data in general. And that was a recurring theme, I thought, throughout the entire discussion that led to this report. We can make the same comment then about metadata standards. We have metadata standards in this field that are specific to geospatial data, dating from 1992. There are generic metadata standards, but typically they've not worked very well for us because they're not specific enough to the geospatial case. There are framework data sets, there are principles of data sharing. All of these are parts of GI science, which are essentially in the data management area, standards for data formats, structures, models, all the work of the Open Geospatial Consortium. And a lot of this came to a head in 1994 with Executive Order 12096 directing the establishment of a national spatial data infrastructure, which was in many ways that set of data management topics. That's back in the days when executive orders didn't occur very often and were actually meaningful. So why the fuss? And what is special about spatial? Why do we want a spatial information science, a geographic information science? Why should GI science be taught in the university? Why is it more than making maps? And I don't in any way want to suggest that making maps is trivial, but certainly maps are one of the things that GI science is about. So why? So that takes me to number two, which is what are the principles of GI science? And as I said at the beginning, this is very much a personal choice. There are many, many competitors and many, many excellent parts of the GI science literature, which I won't be talking about. You may notice that what I am talking about are principles that are empirically grounded. In other words, they're observations about the world, not about the systems, not about the people, but specifically about the world. So I'd like to start here. I'm sure some of you have seen this map before, but to me it's a very significant map. This is a map of cancer mortality, 1950 to 1969, by county for the conterminous United States, and specifically cancers of the respiratory system, trachea, bronchus, and lung, and specifically for white males. And what you are doing as you look at this is noticing the anomalies and asking yourself why. What do I know about this particular area and why it should have a particularly high rate of lung cancer? Oh, this is happening again. Here we go. Great. Okay, so why that? Well, that's Las Vegas. Why does Las Vegas have a high rate of... Now, notice that what we're looking at here is not actually rate. This is significance of the rate. So this is significance of the departure from the national average. And it is difficult for a low population county, such as in the High Plains, to have a significantly high rate. It's much easier for a highly populated county, such as Los Angeles County, to have a high rate. What I'd like to focus on specifically, there are many stories. This is a very interesting map. But I'd like specifically to focus on this. We're in Montana, and your mind is asking, what do I know about that particular spot in western Montana that might account for a particularly high rate of respiratory cancers? And if I brought up the county map, we're looking actually at two counties, Deer Lodge and Silver Bow. And at this point, some of you may have made the connection to Butte and Anaconda and the world's largest copper mines at that time. And what has happened here is that, by chance, those two counties contain both the environmental hazard and the residential locations of the people who are subjected to that. They're both contained within the same county. So, as we go back more generally, we might ask, well, what is, if that's happened by chance, what else has happened in the United States that we can't see? For example, if there was an anomaly in San Bernardino County, which is more than 100,000 square kilometers, the chances are that it will be swamped by the rest of the county. Or if there was an anomaly in Manassas Park County, Virginia, which is less than 8 square kilometers, our chances of combining both the residential locations and the occupational hazard would again be missed. So it is largely chance that has given us that particular anomaly, chance in the drawing of the county boundaries. Now, this is what we would call in the business the modifiable aerial unit problem, and is one of the principles that has already been discussed this morning. It's the dependence of results on the spatial units which are analyzed. And we know that changing those spatial units will always change the results of the analysis. Here's another. Here is Mississippi and the counties of Mississippi and a scatter plot of the percent black of each county and the median value of house. And you observe a negative relationship. Higher the percent black, the lower the average value of house in Mississippi. You say, I've discovered something interesting. My spatial analysis has given me a new discovery. And you publish this and you forget to mention in the conclusions that you were using Mississippi. So then perhaps you repeat the analysis with California. And if this is a general principle and replicable, you should find the same result for California. Of course, you don't. Instead, you get a positive relationship in California. Why is this happening? Because the black population in Mississippi is largely rural, and the black population in California is largely urban. And so we get a complete lack of generalizability, a reversal of the results by changing the geographic area. So we've got two principles so far. The results of any spatial analysis change when the units of analysis change. It's the cancer and counties example, the modifiable aerial unit problem. And secondly, generalization from one geographic area to another is always problematic. This is the principle of spatial heterogeneity. The Earth is not uniform. It's impossible to imagine an average place on the Earth's surface. This is uncontrolled variance. So when you change your study area, you change the results. Percent old age pensioner, let's read percent over 65, in Southeast England, and this is a fairly low level of aggregation of census data. And again, your eye is picking out the anomalies. People don't age in place in central London. People instead evacuate to the south coast. It's a peculiar British habit of heading for the seaside. And there are anomalies which stick out. Why, for example, is that area particularly high in percent OAP? Why is that area high? Clearly, people like the North Gloucestershire and the Cotswolds, and they like rural Essex. So the eye is picking out anomalies, and let's make that into a general principle, which is Tobler's first law of geography, which already came up this morning. Simply stated, nearby things are more similar than distant things. This is the principle behind spatial interpolation. If this wasn't true, you couldn't draw contour maps, you couldn't create regions, you couldn't use spatial interpolation. In fact, if it wasn't true, slope would be meaningless, because the Earth's surface is infinitely rugged if it's not true. So one corollary is that anomalies immediately become interesting. And we just saw that when I picked out some anomalous counties. These are the hot spots, the cold spots of any spatial distribution. These are high surrounded by low or low surrounded by high. And a very awkward, corollary, which again came up this morning, geographic information, because of this lack of independence, will always lead us to question the basic assumptions of inferential statistics. You cannot apply standard inferential statistics, which assumes that all of the cases are drawn independently and randomly from a single population. That is simply not supportable in the geographic world. So those are some principles, and I said at the outset this was very much a personal choice, and these are all of them empirical. They're all of them principles which we observe to be true, or more or less true, of the geographic world. Now let's come to ethics. This came up yesterday, and it's something that we do often forget. If you look at the Wordle that's part of the publicity for this meeting and try to find any ethics topic, you may find eventually, if you look very carefully, that privacy is there, but only if you look very carefully. Yeah. So what happened in the history here is that GIS was criticized very strongly, starting in about 1988, running to about 2000, and for various reasons, of which I've just listed four here. A lot of discomfort because the representations were so simplistic. GIS was analyzing a world which suddenly changed from one category to another. GIS was failing to recognize its roots in military and intelligence communities. A lot of the techniques of remote sensing were developed in the intelligence community in the early 1960s. GIS, because it was expensive at that time, empowered the already powerful and further marginalized the marginalized. And GIS was potentially a surveillance technology and therefore invaded individual privacy. So a very heavy, and as I say, these are not the only suggestions. A rapprochement, starting in about 1995, running till today. With some of the features, public participation GIS, a very important effort to reach to the marginalized. GIS-2. An idea that we could rethink GIS to avoid some of these issues. The alt GIS community, which is still active, the critical GIS community, all of these focused on critiques of GIS. And then the fourth, I'd like to talk about the changing landscape, so the ways in which the landscape of GIS science is changing. And I want to talk about two specific topics. One, of course, which is very much central here, big data. because big data is giving us finer spatial and temporal resolution with all sorts of implications. It's giving us a new interest in dynamics because of the velocity aspect of big data. It's giving us new variables because of the variety aspect, new methods, faster computation, new questions. All of these are things we've heard about in the last day and a half. I think to me the most interesting of those is the new questions. What are the new questions that we can ask now that we can never ask before? This is much deeper, I think, than simply speed up. The fact that we can have another cup of coffee instead of having to watch the computer is not a major breakthrough. But asking new questions certainly is. And then secondly, what I'd call consumerization. And this is part of the neo-geography trend, the engagement of the general public in these technologies, crowdsourcing, in which the average citizen is both a consumer and a producer of geographic data, and a shift in emphasis away from space and its coordinates to places and their names. Something you have to deal with in any consumer-oriented technology. Let's look briefly at big data volumes, because it's easy to make the case that big data volumes are nothing new in GI science. Landsat we've had since 1972. If you do the numbers on Landsat, 30 meter pixel, 500 times 10 to the 12 square meters, 500 times 10 to the 9 pixels, four bands, 20 coverages a year, you end up with about 40 terabytes of data per year for 40 years, which is about a petabyte. And we have now reached the point where that entire petabyte is available in a single cube. It's been assembled based on constant pixels and allows you to slice it horizontally or vertically in ways that are much more creative than we've had in the past. So big data volumes are nothing new. We have dealt with it, with big data volumes, by the strategy of divide and conquer. So much of the research on Landsat has used a single frame, a single scene, which there are about 50,000 to cover the Earth, and it's dealt with it by downloading and analyzing each scene separately, hoping that your area of interest lies entirely within one scene, hoping that interactions of interest don't extend across scene boundaries. In other words, classic divide and conquer, a classic approach to dealing with data volume. So the downside of divide and conquer then has been the potential to miss long distance effects. Here's a new question, the question of teleconnections. What teleconnections exist in the spaces that we work with in GI science, similar to the kinds of teleconnections that have been discovered in atmospheric science? How to generalize from the analysis of one scene? Always a problem because of the principle I talked about earlier of spatial heterogeneity. Now, consumerization, and this, to me, represents a lot of the success of consumerization. This is my house in Seattle. This is McCall Hall. I'm going to the ballet with my wife, and I've asked Google how to get there, and Google is telling me to follow this route. It's 5 miles, and it's going to take me 23 minutes because of this appalling, but common, congestion on I-5. Notice, however, that is neither the shortest route in time nor the shortest route in distance. So Google is making some kind of compromise between time and distance. There is a huge amount of technology underneath this. I had a privilege a couple of years ago of reviewing the entire code. It's about 17 million lines of code. Enormous richness in the data sets underlying this, the street data sets and the point of interest data sets, which essentially contain every address in Seattle and every business and every feature of any significance. And a lot of this based on volunteer geographic information. Most of the congestion information, for example, comes from Waze or from overhead cameras or loop detectors. This, to me, is a triumph of technology, that we can do this in less than a second, and we can do it billions of times a day. And the product is useful only to me, only right now. A totally different perspective on cartography from what we have traditionally had. And we can go down to finer levels of detail. This is one of the products from the group that Alex Singleton was talking about this morning. We're looking at Japanese minority in Camden and London there. A level of detail that we've never had in the past, as long as we've had to rely on classic data sources. Now, the last point, and I'll start with this, which is a quotation from The Little Prince by Saint-Exupéry. It is not the geographer who goes out to count the towns, the rivers, the mountains, the seas, the oceans, and the deserts. The geographer is much too important to go loafing about. He does not leave his desk, but he receives the explorers in his study. He asks them questions, and he notes down what they recall of their travels. The geographer, in doing so, is creating a virtual reality. The geographer is not part of reality. The geographer is relying on reports of reality. Now let's bring in the fourth paradigm. And the fourth paradigm has been a strong theme throughout this meeting so far. The mantra, let the data speak for themselves, is the mantra underlying data-driven science. But geospatial data are never geography for a number of reasons. It is impossible to measure location perfectly. Location is a measurement problem. No measurement instrument can ever be perfect. All geospatial data are subject to a myriad of uncertainties, and many forms of spatial data are not replicable. Think soil map, think land cover map. These are not replicable in a scientific sense. All geographic data is generalized, abstracted, synthesized. Detail is always truncated. Hence I say, geospatial data are never geography. So when the data speak for themselves, they do not speak for geography. And the difference, in order to compensate for that, is something we leave entirely to the researcher. It is what goes on in the head of the researcher. The database cannot tell you how imperfect it is, cannot tell you what it's missing. So here is the famous painting by Vermeer from 1669 of the geographer. It hangs in Frankfurt in the Art Museum. And Roger Downs at Penn State has a wonderful little paper on this in which he recounts the belief, well documented, that Vermeer's original design had the geographer looking at the map. In other words, in virtual reality. And later changed his mind and had the geographer look out the window. In other words, augmented reality. And what this is saying is that it is only by having some experience of the real world that the geographer can assess the differences between the virtual reality of the database and reality itself. And that is only something that the geographer can do. Hence, critical spatial thinking. What needs to be going on in the head of someone using these technologies? So, summary points. Spatial is special. I don't think there's any question about that. But many of the developments in GI science are not necessarily domain-specific, and it's always an interesting question to ask when we get into things like data management policies. To what extent are they specific to spatial data? To what extent are they domain-specific? Coordinates in space-time open a vast array of possibilities. We've heard today about context, the old geographer's distinction between site and situation, the distances distances we can calculate from coordinates, the interpolations we can create, the spatially explicit analysis and modeling that we can do. And I had a very interesting lunch a few years ago with an economist at Brown after I'd given a talk, and he made a very interesting assertion. He said that he thought he could get as much insight from the data I've been talking about if he had had access to any pair of socially significant variables. I was making the case, of course, that access to coordinates was insightful. His point was that any pair, employment, education, would be equally insightful. And we went at it for the rest of the lunch, and I think we agreed to differ. But I think this is a very interesting question to ask. More summary points. If data science is about prediction, and in many ways it is, many of the classic examples of the success of data science are predictions, then knowledge of space and time can enable a different kind of prediction, which is a prediction of where and possibly when. So there is a spatial version of prediction, if you see data science as an approach to prediction. And then finally, current interest in data science is an opportunity for GI science. I think we've seen that made abundantly here. And so carpe diem. Thank you very much.